What does the United States need to defend itself? This week, President Bush said the United States will vacate the 1972 anti-ballistic missile treaty, which he considers outmoded. And yesterday at his ranch in Texas, the president also said he would fight to have Congress approve his proposed $18.4 billion increase in defense spending.
Now, I readily concede if Congress goes off on a spending spree in other areas, it's going to create a competition for defense dollars. And my point is going to be to the members of the United States Congress and their constituents that national defense ought to be a funding priority, and I expect it to be.
The President of the United States, Dan Shore, is away, so with us once again to discuss the week's news is our friend John Heilemann of Wired Magazine, joining us from member station WBUR in Boston. John, thanks for being back with us.
Great to be here, Scott.
Is the president going to get the fight he seems to welcome with Congress over defense spending?
Oh, yeah. I think he's going to get a big fight. I mean, I think the president is about to learn how much harder it is to get your budget through when the Democrats control the Senate than it was when the Republicans were controlling both houses of Congress. This week, Kent Conrad, the budget chairman, and Robert Byrd, the appropriations chairman, both said that they would oppose Bush's $18 billion defense increase proposal. That's the biggest proposal since the Reagan administration. They say it's too big. The surplus, we're going to talk about the question of the budget surplus in a second, but they say the surplus has dwindled. There's no money for this. They're also upset about the fact that the Pentagon's much vaunted defense review that Don Rumsfeld, the head of the Defense Department, has been undertaking. There's no results of that yet. It looks like it's going nowhere. And even some Republicans are worried about this $18 billion appropriation without having seen any results from that review.
Let me ask you about Secretary Rumsfeld's role, because he came into the administration as the blue chip candidate. He'd been there before, after all, but he does seem to have faltered in a couple of steps, hasn't he?
Yeah, he's had a really sort of a rough week. Rumsfeld, of course, was the heavyweight, the great bureaucratic warrior who defeated Henry Kissinger and everyone quaked in their boots. Now he's met his match, I guess, in the Pentagon. I mean, this week he had a number of small stumbles. He gave a press interview to Time magazine where he sort of expressed surprise that Washington, D.C. had changed since the last time he was there in 1974. He was shocked, shocked that there are such things as leaks that go on. He also said that he was avoiding a bunch of really central issues to the Pentagon, things like procurement and industry mergers, because it turns out he's still got a lot of stock in defense companies. So he's got some conflicts of interest. But the biggest issue, as I say, is this defense review. And here he threw up his hands last week, and he had talked earlier about forcing large reductions in the forces in the Army, the Navy, and the Marines, and the Air Force. And last week he said, well, maybe I'm not going to force those reductions. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'll just, in fact, let the generals decide. I mean, the kind of bleak conclusion to this may be that the Defense Department, the military, is in fact, in some respects, unreformable. If Don Rumsfeld can't do it, if Les Aspin, if you remember the first Clinton defense chief, who was the great to be the great reformer from the liberal side, couldn't do it. I mean, who can do it?
Let me ask about the budget surplus, because that seems to be at the heart of a lot of different policies, the various projections that people make. Now, President Bush suggested this week he actually welcomes a dwindling budget surplus because he thinks it's going to keep the Democrats from spending it. Are they talking about different figures as to what that dwindle is?
Yeah, well, you know the old saw, Scott, that there are lies and damned lies and statistics. Well, it turns out there's one category that's even lower on the veracity totem pole, and that's budget projections and economic projections. The Democrats are attacking the Bush administration, saying that they are back in bed with that great old Washington mistress, Miss Rosie scenario, and that their projection for next year, 3.2% economic growth, is way higher than is realistic. And certainly there are very few private sector economists or independent economists who take that rosy view. Next week, the Congressional Budget Office is going to come out with its projections, and it seems pretty likely that they will be grimmer than the Bush administration's projections. So the Democrats are probably right that the Bush administration is being too optimistic. But it does put the Democrats in a bizarre position to be making this argument, as the former Labor Secretary Robert Reich pointed out in a couple of venues this week. The Democrats have now somehow become the party that's its economic policy is based on balancing the budget. It is the party of fiscal conservatism. Traditionally, the Democrats were the Keynesians, right? When there was a downturn, what they wanted to do was spend more money, somehow prime the pump. Now the Republicans are the party that wants to do that. This week, Larry Lindsey, George Bush's chief economic advisor said that if the downturn in the economy continues, we might need more tax cuts, which is kind of classic Keynesianism. So you've got Keynesian Republicans and you've got Democrats sounding like Calvin Coolidge. I don't know if this is just a role reversal, if it's budgetary cross-dressing or what, but it's kind of weird.
Let me ask about events overseas. In Argentina, there's a deepening economic crisis. International Monetary Fund this week approved loaning, I guess, $8 billion. That's on top of the $14 billion already sent. Is this a reasonable investment for the industrial world to make?
Well, you know, it's interesting, Scott. You know, last week we talked about Israel, and I was saying, you know, the Bush administration wants to be somewhat more hands-off and less interventionist, but the world keeps pulling the Bush administration in. Mm-hmm. This is another case that's just like that, except it's in the financial and economic realm, and the demands are even more urgent in some respects because of the nature of globalization and the increasing integration of financial markets and the world's economies. The fear now is contagion, right? That if Argentina falls, then the flu will spread to other Latin American countries and conceivably to other emerging markets. And so the Bush administration finds itself worried not just about the fate of Argentina, but about the fate of you know, in large chunks of the global economy. And as I say, you know, it's very difficult to resist when the stakes become that high. It's very hard to suddenly to turn a blind eye to those demands.
Senator Jesse Helms of North Carolina, formerly chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee when the Republicans had the Senate, says he's going to retire in 2003. Does this mark the passing of a certain breed of politician?
Well, I think it certainly does, although it's more, and people have been asking that question this week, is this the kind of end of a conservative era? You've got Nastia Jesse Helms retiring, but Strom Thurmond, of course, also expected to retire shortly. I think that, you know, that both of them really represent not so much the end of an era of conservatism, but they're sort of the last dying gasp of a sort of a bygone kind of conservatives. They're you know, powerful figures, very, they're kind of conviction politicians, and they have in Helms in particular, whether you like what he represents or don't like what he represents, he's been an amazingly effective legislator fighting for those causes over his many years in the Senate. But he really is very much out of step, even with the most conservative elements of his party. Now he's, you know, pretty much a kind of a vestige of the old segregationist South. He's sort of a nativist, isolationist, and decidedly anti-modern. I think that even very, very, very conservative Republicans sort of see him as not the kind of face that the new Republican Party wants to have. And though they honor him, they are not all that upset to see him go.
John, I don't think we can delay this. We got about a minute left. Gary Condit, what do you think? How did he do?
Well, you know, Gary Condit, my God, I mean, the man, you watched him on television, and I think Tom Shales wrote that he looked like Jack Lord from the old Hawaii Five-0. He went on, you know, he was supposed to be, you know, speaking out for the first time, and what he did was essentially, with words, do what he's done all summer long, which is stonewall. He looked terrible, he looked evasive, he looked shifty. He didn't change, I think, anybody's mind about whether or not he's involved in one way or the other about when Chandra Levy, in the Chandra Levy disappearance. But what Gary Condit's game must be at this point is, you know, he tried to get through the summer by not saying anything. The story wouldn't go away. And maybe he thinks that what he's trying to do here is send a message to the media, which is that I'm not going to take part in this. I am going to continue to wait this out. You're not going to get anything juicy from me. And if it turns out that this story does finally subside a little bit, although he looked terrible, it may end up having been a savvier strategy than it looks right now.
John, thanks very much.
No problem, Scott. Good to talk to you.
John Heilman of Wired Magazine, speaking from WBUR in Boston.